The Secrets of Star Trek is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit givestarquest.com. You're listening to The Secrets of Star Trek, where we discuss the hidden layers and deeper meanings found in all the Star Trek TV series, movies, and more. And today we're discussing the animated series episode, BEM. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
You don't look like a bug-eyed monster, Dom.
We'll get into that. And Father Jason Tyler. Hey, Father.
Hello.
Folks, be sure to stick around. We've got more of your great listener feedback, this time on our recent episode Concerning Flight, the Voyager episode about Leonardo da Vinci. But in the meantime, Jimmy, can you give us a recap of BEM?
This week, the Enterprise is playing host to an observer from the planet Pandro named Airy Ben Bem. He's been hiding out in his quarters rather than observing, though, but suddenly he insists on going on an away mission to a primitive planet where the crew is going to plant monitoring devices. As soon as they beam down, the audience, but not the crew, learns that Bem is a composite creature who can detach various body parts. He uses this ability to switch Kirk's and Spock's phasers and communicators with fakes. He then gets himself captured by the primitive lizard men natives. When Kirk and Spock try to rescue him, he explains that getting captured is his way of observing. So we're dealing with a really alien observer with a really alien thought process. Kirk and Spock bust him out of the primitive stockade anyway, but just as they're escaping, an immaterial godlike alien paralyzes them. The immaterial alien explains that the lizard people are her children, and the Federation folks need to take their monitoring devices and get the heck off of her planet. They're willing to do that, but Bem has escaped again, so they have to catch him. Scotty and some security guys beam down, and now that they know how important the lizard people are, Kirk tells the security guys to use the lightest possible stun setting and only to fire if absolutely necessary. So the security guys immediately start blasting away with reckless abandon. Soon they've chased away the lizard men and got Bem back. The immaterial alien is angry to discover that they're still on the planet, but they explained that they needed to get Bem back so he couldn't interfere with her children. Bem is so broken up about his own failures of some kind or another that he wants to commit suicide, but the alien talks him out of it, and we get a happy ending. The end.
Father, what'd you think?
It's okay. I mean, you know, the Kirk and Spock in captivity kept me a little bit interested, you know, wondering how they were going to resolve that, what was going to be their way of getting out. But this, we see some things here we've seen in other episodes, right? Kirk having to convince a superior power to let him go, losing weapons, and then not being able to fight an inferior species for, you know, because of the loss of their weapons or whatnot. But at the same time, the distractions around Bem make it hard to figure out what's going on in some way. Like, why did he take their communicator and phasers? And is this really the good way, a good way to observe and establish diplomatic relations? And how exactly does Bem function when he separates into those various parts, you know, with digestion and locomotion and whatever else? So,
yeah, similar questions. How about you, Jimmy? What'd you think of this one?
Yeah, I would probably give it a 4 out of 10. It's not horrible, maybe a 3. It's not horrible, and it's got some nice stuff in it, but it ain't what I would exactly call good. It's got some okay stuff, but Bem himself, I don't mind the fact that they're trying to show us an alien that has a really alien thought process. Mm-hmm. That's good. I don't mind the fact that they're trying to show us an alien that's really alien, you know, that's not just a human with a bumpy forehead. But the execution, I think, leaves a good bit to be desired. There's the questions that Father Tyler raised, and some of those, Some of those, I think it's okay for them not to go into, like, how does digestion work with this alien? I assume that he's got a digestive apparatus in his torso and that converts food into, you know, blood glucose or some equivalent that's then shared with the other body parts when they are in contact. Also, I don't mind that they have his body parts levitating. this was something that the author of this is David Gerrold.
One of the greats.
Author of The Trouble with Tribbles, for example. And he didn't like the fact that they animated Bim's body parts so that they floated through the air. Personally, I don't mind that, because if they showed them crawling around with little arms and stuff, we would be so into John Carpenter's The Thing, it would not be funny.
That would be creepy.
Yeah. Similarly, I don't mind having an alien thought process. I like that, but it raises lots of questions, and I don't need all of those questions answered, but a lot of Bim's decisions seem to be, a lot of the questions I have about his thought process remain underdeveloped by the end of the episode, I would say.
Yeah. I agree. It wasn't great. It's sort of a notorious episode. I think Bim becomes notorious among fans as one of the least likable non-villains, because he's not exactly a villain in this. There's actually not really a villain in this at all, but he's just very alien. But he's kind of notorious for being people like, what a jerk, because he's kind of a jerk throughout it.
Yeah. I think a much better play on the same thing would be Darmok.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also not a villain, but
right.
But yeah, that it, the truly alien that you're trying to understand.
Yeah.
That is a better Star Trek story.
And that is one where there's an alien thought process that gets explored, that gets explained somewhat, maybe not completely, but explained enough to, you know, bring some logic into the episode, so to speak.
Right. Jimmy, you alluded to the fact that the name Bim was a bit of an inside joke, because it was used, I guess, especially in early sci-fi, it was sort of used for bug-eyed monster, the common, you know, really strange monsters that you would encounter, as opposed to very human looking, because again, in the more primitive age of, you just mostly, everything's mostly makeup, getting something truly alien was more interesting.
I do want to, and I think I'd probably give this one a 4. It apparently, this is a very divisive episode, with some people ranking it really low and others ranking it really high. And I kind of put it in the middle. It does have some really nice stuff in it. One of them is the first canonical occurrence of Kirk's middle name as Tiberius,
which, that's right,
it had been established. Now, in the second pilot, his middle initial was R, because it appears on a tombstone that Gary Mitchell makes for him. But then by the series, they changed it to T, and nobody knew what it stood for. And this was a question that got asked at fan conventions. And apparently David Gerrold joked it was Tiberius just on the spot. And eventually it ended up in the show. Also, this has a nice line, that a nice humorous line, because this is meant to be a humor episode. But when Kirk and Spock are in this, you know, wooden cage or set of wooden cages, Kirk is kind of like, so why aren't you more on top of this, Mr. Spock, getting us out of here? And Spock gets the line, Captain, I'm only a Vulcan, you know, instead of I'm only human.
The other good line there was Kirk starting off by saying, how come we always end up like this?
Yeah, that was, it's like, OK, we're hanging a lantern on it, aren't we?
Yeah,
that was good. Father, you brought up a good question that occurred to me as well. Why does Bim switch the communicators and phasers? What does that get him? Because I don't know. Like, it doesn't really pay off except for the sake of the show.
It's part of his. That one, I think I've that one didn't bug me too much. I mean, I had to think about it for a second, but then it occurred to me it's all part of his, he's testing Kirk and Spock.
Okay.
To see how good they are, because he's heard like this is the best captain and stuff. So let's see how he functions under adversity.
Okay.
And that's why he gets himself captured. And that's why he switches the devices. He's making it hard for Kirk.
Yeah. Right. Right.
At various points, I kept thinking, OK, this guy must be in league with the entity or whoever is, you know, wanting to capture Kirk and Spock or wanting to cause problems, because he kept doing so many things that was that were contributing to their capture and to their continued imprisonment.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
By the way, there another thing I really like about this episode, mm-hmm. Uhura gets command.
Yes, that was good.
And here I wish they'd made it more explicit,
right,
like they do the first time. Mm-hmm. But she's in command, and she is a competent commander, and I just love seeing Uhura in command.
By the book, she's very by the book too.
Yeah,
I wish they would have shown her sitting in the chair. You know, that's what they don't have. They have her standing next to the chair at one point, but not sitting in it. And that
would have been sufficient if they just had her sit in the chair. Mm-hmm. That would have visually communicated the reality of the situation.
Right.
Yep.
Also she plays the godlike alien.
Yes.
And one question they never answer is, and I assume because she's an energy creature and the lizard men are lizard men, I assume they're not biologically related. So these are my children as a metaphor.
Yeah.
But also we're dealing with alien aliens here. Maybe they ascend at some point.
Mm. Very Stargate-y.
Yeah, just something I wondered about. But apparently, in adding the godlike alien was, and they don't, it, you don't have to read it as godlike. And I mean, they kind of mention it in the last scene.
Yeah.
But I just thought it's an advanced alien. But apparently, Gene Roddenberry insisted they add a godlike alien to this, which David Gerald was unhappy about, because it's like, oh, another godlike alien. We have done this, dude.
Yes.
But it ended up working okay. By the way, this script was originally planned for the third season of the original series. And then it got bumped, and then it got not used, and then they brought it back for the animated series.
I'd love to see how they would have done Bem.
I think it would have been horrible. Depicting a colony creature on a 1960s TV budget, especially a third season one, it's like I would have punted this one too.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting too, you mentioned colony creature, that it reminds me that, you know, once the landing party sees what Bem really is, they don't describe him as, oh, he's a guy who separates into various parts. They say right away, he's a colony creature. So clearly they've encountered other aliens that have a similar function or similar way of being.
Yeah.
Yeah. The godlike alien is interesting because it reminded me a lot of the one from Metamorphosis, which is that from Cochrane, you know, the whole shiny legs thing. I wonder if they're related. In the beginning,
Kirk that's says, my sister.
Oh, she's got that human boyfriend of hers. Oh, so Kirk says, we're investigating a pre-warp civilization. Don't take unnecessary risks. as opposed to the necessary ones, your prime directive and prime directive doesn't apply to Bem, I guess, because he's not a Federation citizen. You know, his planet is not part of the Federation yet. So, just watching Bem put Kirk in the corner, making him take it, I don't want to take this guy, but I have no choice. That was actually kind of a fun moment, a fun little scripting of that scene.
Apparently part of the humor of this and part of the original idea when this was planned for the third season was Bem was going to come across as a practical joker. And that actually causes us an issue, because the very next issue of the animated series is called Practical Joker. So they've got two Practical Joker episodes in a row, but Bim doesn't so much come across to me. There's a little humor in some of the stuff he does, but he doesn't come across to me as an actual practical joker. He just is doing bizarre things for no apparent reason. Maybe you need a laugh track.
Right. So at one point on the bridge, they say, I don't know, it's a Sulu or Arix or somebody, but they're like, oh, there's a sensor field on the planet that detects. That's showing Brownian movement. What is Brownian movement?
Brownian motion is like what you observe when you have a glass of clear water or other liquid and you drop a food color in it. Uh-huh. And the food color kind of blooms in this pattern as it moves through the water until the whole water is suffused with a light color tint. And actually Albert Einstein used Brownian motion to help prove the atomic theory of matter. In 1905, that's how recent we got proof of atoms.
Wow.
And so it doesn't quite make sense, but they are trying to incorporate a science term. They're just using it wrong as as normal.
Okay. Well, it's kind of like Aboriginal seems to get used in a different way here than I would expect, right? Doesn't Aboriginal normally mean the people who originally occupied or inhabited a place?
Yeah.
And rather than they're using it here to mean primitive, I think. But, you know, when they say this planet is populated by Aboriginal life forms, well, isn't any planet that hasn't been colonized populated by Aboriginal life forms?
Good point. I hadn't thought of that. I assumed they just meant they're natives. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that they meant primitive. Mm-hmm. But that may be the implication of that line.
Yeah, Aboriginal. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
Bim has an unusual mode of speech. Uh-huh. That they maintain throughout, which is not as extreme as Yoda or Jar Jar Binks, but it's there.
Yep.
He has a noun first pattern where the modifier comes after the noun. So he'll refer to Kirk Captain instead of Captain Kirk. Mm. He also has a form of indirect speech that's a little like Japanese, where he'll say, "This one has decided," meaning "I have decided." Mm.
Right. Which makes it more understandable, given that he is a kind of a colony creature. He has a collective identity. So he is one, but can be disassembled in the sense of the pieces can be and the collective identity can be dispersed. I think that was what he was saying at the end.
Just like Japanese people?
No, but just like, I'm saying like the way he refers to himself as one, this one, he is one now, like one identity.
Yeah, I think you're overthinking it. But
okay,
that maybe. Do you?
Or this one.
Yeah.
My pronouns. Yeah. Bim says he won't demean himself to use violence to accomplish his goals, sort of condescending. But it's okay for Kirk to demean himself to save Bim. You know, he kind of says, but if you wish to use violence to save me, that would be fine. It's like, oh, that's nice and convenient. It's very Kai Wynn of him to say it that way.
Yeah, in fact, he comes across as pretty as it goes along. I mean, he starts kind of arrogant, but I kind of give him a pass on that because we're getting the plot moving and he's an alien who's really alien. But then after we start to understand what he's doing and he's like testing Kirk and stuff, he's really running down Kirk and being an arrogant guy.
Yeah. And he later on, he's like he kind of alternates. First, he says he's shamed. Then he stubbornly insists that he lives by his own rules. And then he's back to being ashamed again. Like, what is it? You know, it was felt out of order in character development. I mean, I know we're asking a lot of a Saturday morning cartoon, but it felt kind of weird. His flipping back and forth. And that's when he resolves to disassemble for his error.
Apparently permanently in some way that is unspecified, which is probably good. Although if you're going to tell children how to commit suicide on Saturday morning TV, it's probably in a way that, it's probably good to do it in a way they can't actually accomplish.
Yeah. Why is Billy pulling on his arm over there? So the entity does convince him. Otherwise, she says, you have erred, but if you disassemble, you cannot learn from your error. Errors demand recognition so that they will not be repeated. And then also then goes on to say, punishment is necessary only where learning cannot occur without it. I'm like, that is fairly accurate and fairly enlightened of it for Saturday morning.
By the way, there's a line in this. Once the godlike entity starts manifesting, which they initially detect as like this is an electromagnetic anomaly or something, they don't realize it's an intelligence, but it grows to the point over the northern continent of the planet that they can't like beam down through it or scan through it properly. And Scott says the Loch Ness monster couldn't get through all that.
That was good. It's the Scotty moment.
Also, there's for once Eric's gets a line that gets some attention in this that he normally doesn't get in the script. I mean, frequently he's just sitting there at his station. Mm-hmm. And recently we saw one where I think he was using Spock's monitor and stuff. But I always like it when they explore these characters like Eric's and Morass. And here we get a little bit, sense of his personality, because after the problem scanning the planet, they ask Eric's if he's been able to find Kirk and Spock. And he basically says, I've made progress, and he lists some factors that would suggest he has found them. But then he issues some caveats about how we shouldn't rely too much on these. And Scott turns to Uhura and says, I think he said maybe. And it's like, okay, that's a nice little character moment. I like that.
I'm always amused by the fact that Morass, the second communications officer, is also Nichelle Nichols. Like, she can't get away from that console. but yeah, I like the, and Eric's is James Doohan.
Are we sure Morass is Nichelle Nichols? I thought she might be Majel Barrett.
I always thought it was. Let me see if I can find Morass. I don't think she actually gets any speaking lines in this one. We just see her at the
console. Not in this one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is Majel Barrett primarily. Yeah. Although apparently someone else voiced her occasionally. Mm. So when the alien entity challenges Kirk at the first time they meet, why are you here? He gave the worst possible answer. Like, we're here to classify this planet. We must test it. Like, what? What does that even mean? Like, we're just here to observe. We're not going to do anything wrong. Would be the right thing to say, but
yeah,
showing up at someone's home and saying, "Hey, we're here to classify your planet." Classify for what purposes?
Yeah, I guess one way he could have said it better. I'm relying on your memory here because I don't remember the details of that line. But he could have said, I mean, they could have communicated the same content by saying we need to test it so we know what category it goes in.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. He says it's our mission. We must classify this planet. We have to test it. And the entity says, classify. What gives you the right to intrude here? This planet is not for your use.
Yeah. Like, so in essence, classify it as not for your use. Go away.
Exactly. We did mention how Ben kind of abandons Spock and Kirk to their fate after he assesses you are not an intelligent commander. That was pretty funny. It was interesting how Kirk decides to use his communicator to try to get the attention of the intelligence, which is not using any mechanical devices as far as they know, but somehow it detects the communication.
Well, it does operate on radio frequencies with Brownian motion.
That's true.
So what they did was they chained Kirk and Spock's communicators together. They basically put them back to back, but some were told that somehow that amplifies the signal they can put out. And that's how they contacted the creature with radio waves.
Right. And you referred to the at the end is where we get this, you know, the whole bridge final moment where Spock compares the entity to almost a god, you might say, is mm-hmm. the line. And Kirk says, the difference is meaningless. And it's like, is it? it's a weird statement to make there.
I'd have to go back and review it. But Kirk then says, we're almost children by comparison.
Yes.
So he obviously acknowledged a difference. Yeah. Maybe he was challenging the idea of a god, like any god would be an alien to us.
Or any alien sufficiently advanced would be, mm-hmm. which is kind of the Clark's
Arthur
law.
C. Clark's law. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, and then Bim says that he's not even a child. He's almost an eggling by comparison. So I guess, okay, now we know a little bit more about how Bim's species reproduce.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All in these little eggs. Do they match up the pieces as they come out? Oh, I got an arm.
Oh, who says they keep all the same parts throughout their life? They might switch them around.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's how Pandronian marriage works.
Yeah. That's
fascinating.
By the way, that would be interesting. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff mm-hmm. that they could explore here. Mm-hmm. By the way, one thing, and I mentioned this in my summary just because it was so striking, but immediately after, it's like, we've got to get our action scene into this. Uh-huh. And immediately after Kirk tells them lightest possible stun, fire yes. only if necessary, we're immediately followed by dramatic shots and swelling music of the security guys just blasting everything in right. sight.
Zap, zap, zap. Like, mom is not going to be happy. Yeah, that was, I saw the same thing. It was funny.
I guess it's partly cultural. Now, I grew up, you know, I was a kid in the 70s and there was some of that, oh, kids shouldn't play with gun stuff or something. And I remember my parents not being overly happy when we were playing some gun based game. I don't know if it was Cops mm-hmm. and Robbers or Cowboys and Indians or what it was. But I remember my parents being a little bit affected by that ideology and I didn't understand it. And I still don't, because men are configured for evolutionarily. We're configured to be defenders.
Give a kid a stick, and it'll be a gun.
If you give a kid a stick, it's going to be a gun. So yeah. don't fight it. This is how they prepare for adulthood. And so I still don't get that, but I guess it's out there.
My 13-year-old daughter was playing with her Nerf gun last night during prayers when mm-hmm. it wasn't supposed to be. And I admonished her for bad trigger discipline.
Yeah.
All right. Any other thoughts on this one, Father?
Nope. We covered all my notes.
Jimmy?
Nope.
All right. So I did have one last thought I was going to say, which was I feel like a lot of people who rate this highly rate it highly because of the uniqueness of Bim. I think the interesting nature of the Pandronian mm-hmm. kind of is what gave it what good it had, I think, mm-hmm. if I could put it that way. So that was my last thought. All right, let's get to our feedback. And this was on our recent episode 416 called Concerning Flight. It's from Voyager. J.A. Bellinger on our Discord community writes in regard to our discussion of referring to things as she and he. Old English did have three grammatical genders, masculine, feminine, and neuter. But the nouns did not have to match their gender. Wifman, which meant wife or women, was actually masculine. Now, for Old English for ship, I believe was actually neuter. So it's probably anthropomorphizing in when we call ships she.
Yeah. So just a couple of notes on that. We still do have grammatical gender in English. It's been largely confined to pronouns. Mm-hmm. Our noun system has lost it. And I wouldn't say that the nouns didn't have to agree. They did and do have to agree with the verb form used, but they don't have to agree with the natural gender mm-hmm. of something. So like in Hebrew, you've got masculine and feminine, and everything is either is grammatically masculine or feminine. There is no neuter. So there is no it in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. It's just he and she. And it's normal in languages for there to be exceptional cases. Like in Latin, the word for farmer is Agricola. And in terms of its grammatical form, it's feminine. But it's used, because farmers tend to be male, it's used as if it's masculine. So it's a little more complex, but I get what you're saying, and you're right. Yeah. Yep. If the older word for ship was grammatically neutral in gender, then the origin of thinking of ships as she would have to be something else. Right. Maybe we got it from Latin or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. The Greek word is ploion, but that would be neuter.
Yeah.
Same root as plow, because ships plow the sea.
See, yeah. Yep. D. Doggall on YouTube writes, when they had that trader on board, they had a merchant aboard, they kicked him out and then let him leave with several of their items, including a phaser rifle. What?
Yeah, well, this is a few centuries later, and they were dealing with a culture that already had weapons. So they were really, all we're trying to get back is the hollow emitter and the computer. They're letting everything else go.
Yeah, that's true. I did note that, though, at the time. JBSC4 wrote on YouTube, well, they lost the computer and thus primary navigation, so they finally got to use paper charts. Mm-hmm. Maybe Neelix had them kicking around in his ship, and then finally,
they got the ones that Leonardo made for him.
Yeah, right, star charts from Leonardo. Kate S3853 also writes on YouTube, I'd love to hear this group's, meaning us, fan fiction. Well, I don't believe either of you write fan fiction, but I do.
I have not.
Yes.
I don't write fan fiction. I write for pay. I did once write a novel on an existing IP, but I've never published it because existing IP, and I'd have to get permissions. But I read a story that made me so mad, the ending of it. It's like, I'm going to fix this ending by writing around it. That's something I've done periodically, is recontextualize. I don't change anything in the original story, but I add to it to totally recontextualize it, so now it makes sense.
Yes. For my part, about 25 years ago, I did several pieces of Star Trek fan fiction, mainly based around the Dominion War. And I've actually recently picked it up again. And I've created a Substack, so I'll put a link if anyone's interested to my my Substack with my Star Trek stories. There's only one there right now, but I've got a couple more I'm reposting from the old days. So thanks for asking, though. All right. So that does it for our feedback and does it for our show. We'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Star Trek, including Connie Z, Rob H, Frank C, Claire R, and David G. I don't think that's David Gerald, but it's a different David G.
Could be.
Their generous donations at givestarquest.com make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Star Trek and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting givestarquest.com. And we encourage you to share the podcast with your friends, help us grow our community and reach even more listeners. And so that's it from us this time. We'd love to know what you thought of BEM. You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/trek, or send us an email to trek@sqpn.com. Visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/discord, or watch The Secrets of Star Trek on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/starquestmedia, where you should do all the usual like, subscribe, and all that stuff. We'll be back next time, where we'll be discussing the Next Generation episode, The High Ground. No Obi-Wan Kenobi in that one. Until then, Father Jason Tyler, thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of Star Trek.
Thanks, Dom.
And Jimmy Akin, thank you as well.
I have a bad feeling about this, but live long and prosper.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to the Secrets of Star Trek on StarQuest. And remember, every planet is dangerous to the ignorant, including ours. Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. Let's Science. Find the show wherever fine podcasts are found, or at sqpn.com/science.